It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Governor Tony Evers announced new recommended guidelines for Wisconsinites as the number of positive cases of COVID-19 climbs in the state. We'll talk to a political reporter and a public health expert about the announcement. First, after major news outlets declared Joe Biden president-elect this past Saturday, incumbent President Donald Trump has not conceded. Most Republican lawmakers have followed his lead, while Trump's administration is blocking Biden's transition team from moving forward. Trump's campaign is filing numerous lawsuits around the country and alleging, without evidence, problems with several states' elections. It's the week in Washington where we look at several top stories in national politics. We'll also look at the Biden team considering some Republicans for administration positions and the runoff Senate elections coming together, it looks like, for Georgia. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your first response to the outcome of the election being called on Saturday? What do you hope the transition looks like? What do you worry it might look like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wong is senior writer for The Hill, covering House of Representatives leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back with you.
Well, let's start with the Biden campaign and the president-elect himself. He's held press conferences so far on the coronavirus and the Affordable Care Act, or given statements on those. Can you talk more about what we're seeing from the Biden transition effort now?
Yeah, I mean, Joe Biden is moving full speed ahead with his transition team. You know, it's a big task for him and his team. And so they are taking advantage of every single day. We're 70 days until January 20th, when Joe Biden will be sworn in as the 46th president. So he has assembled in recent days this bipartisan coronavirus task force. That's going to be his biggest challenge as he heads into his presidency. He has launched landing teams for all of the different federal agencies. These are experts who know all of these different agencies or who have worked with them in the past and trying to understand, you know, what the state is in all of these different federal agencies, where the need is, what needs to change. Just yesterday, he fielded a bunch of congratulatory calls from world leaders from Germany, France, Ireland, the UK. And so he is acting presidential. And so, although there is this dispute, the Trump campaign has disputed the results of the election. They are contesting and appealing and challenging the election legally in many of these states. Joe Biden is trying to stay above the fray and continue moving forward and acting as presidential as possible.
And yeah, on the president's side of things, the current president's side of things, as you said, legal options, which they, of course, have the right to pursue in states, a likely recount request coming here in Wisconsin, it sounds like. And on a parallel track, also a lot of claims of widespread fraud without evidence, apparently, to back it up. What are we seeing from the Trump side of things here?
Yeah, and without evidence are the operative words here. You know, while the bulk of Republicans on Capitol Hill are giving Trump space to make these claims and are backing him up for the most part, there are a number of senior statesmen in the party, like Mitt Romney, who have said it is time to move on. They are recognizing he and others like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, as well as a number of other establishment Republican figures like William Cohen, the former defense secretary who served under President Clinton, who happened to be a Republican, also said that this is very inappropriate for President Trump not to be conceding the race and recognizing Joe Biden as the president-elect. So there is a bit of a internal strife happening within the Republican Party right now. I think most people believe that at the end of the day, Joe Biden will be seated as the next president of the United States. But because of the turmoil that we've seen over the last 4 years with President Trump, there's still, you know, there's always going to be an open question about what the president might do next. And we have seen that play out just this week at the Pentagon with the series of changes that he's made.
Right. I wanted to ask about that next. Defense Secretary Mark Esper out, along with other key deputies, the ones who by law would have succeeded him in his position. Other civilian positions changed. The general consensus is replaced with people more loyal to President Trump. One of the big fallings out between the president and the now former defense secretary, Esper, had criticized the idea of using active duty military troops to help suppress protests. What do we know about the changes in the Defense Department?
You know, this is not my area of expertise, but I will say that, you know, just from reading my colleagues and speaking to my colleagues who cover the Pentagon, they say that President Trump has largely installed a loyalist, and we've seen that throughout his 4 years where people will speak up or challenge him on controversial issues, and those people will quickly be replaced with people who fall in line with the president and the president's thinking. I think that's what is happening here. The strange thing about the timing of some of these personnel moves at the Pentagon right now is they come just days after the presidential race was called for Joe Biden. And so there's a lot of consternation, I think, and hand-wringing on Capitol Hill as to what the president is up to. Some sources say that the president may be wanting, you know, with a limited calendar left for his presidency, may be wanting to accelerate the withdrawal of troops in the Middle East and Afghanistan. That's something that he promised during his campaign. And maybe he sees some of these civilian officials like Esper and others as standing in the way of that goal.
It's The Week in Washington, talking to Scott Wong from The Hill, looking at some of the big stories, including the presidential transition. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to a caller now. Jeffrey is with us in De Pere. Jeffrey, hi.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. I would like for the state of Wisconsin congressmen, women, and senators, men and women, representatives, to stand up and put the kibosh on this garbage. McCarthyism is dead. Roy Cohn is dead. Roger Stone is no longer a trickster for Richard Nixon. What is this man that calls himself the president? Why does he want to be the greatest winner of all time? This isn't a win. This is a country. Move forward, cross the aisle, shake hands. Let's get this taken care of. If he wants to go home to New York and join the mob families, that's fine.
Jeffrey, I think we get the gist. Thanks for calling. He calls himself president because he is the president now, of course. I want to give a listen to Jeffrey's talk about Wisconsin's congressional delegation. I think maybe about our state legislature as well. Here's a listen to Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson being asked about the declaration for Biden.
Senator, have you congratulated Vice President Biden yet?
No.
Why not?
Nothing to congratulate him about, he says. Johnson kind of didn't break stride to answer the questions on the way through. The state legislature here in Wisconsin calling for at least a review of the election by a key committee. Senator Johnson not alone in that response, Scott.
Yeah, that's right. And Republicans on Capitol Hill have been put in a very difficult spot. You know, under normal circumstances, they would be reaching across the aisle and congratulating the winner of this election, Joe Biden. But that hasn't happened because these are not usual times under this president. And so, you know, we have seen in the past contested elections in our lifetime, certainly in 2000 with Bush and Gore in the recount in Florida. But the difference there was that they were separated by about 500 and some odd votes. In many of these cases where the Trump campaign is contesting the election, such as Pennsylvania just crossed the 50,000 vote threshold, meaning that Biden has 50,000 more votes than President Trump does. It would be very, very almost impossible to overturn that result if you did any sort of recount. In some of the other states like yours and in Georgia, certainly the numbers are much closer, but we're not talking about a repeat of Florida in 2000 by any stretch.
About 20,500 in Wisconsin. By the unofficial tally, the canvassing to confirm those numbers is going on right now. Thanks for that call. We'll go to Jeff now in Madison. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I know it sounds a bit far-fetched, although I'm seeing it more and more, the word used online in interviews, etc. But at what point legally does it become a coup if he refuses to leave the White House? Is it at swearing-in time or some other date?
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. People are wondering, you know, if and when the president decides to, if not concede, then to acknowledge the results, what happens on January 20th if he doesn't?
Well, I don't know, because I don't think we've ever seen this circumstance before. The Constitution does not require the losing candidate to concede the race, so there is no requirement for Trump to concede in order for Biden to become president. Biden's team has made that very point. They are taking, I think, some of these challenges seriously. They have a well-funded legal team that is challenging the Trump campaign at every step of the way, where they're trying to make inroads. And so they are taking these threats seriously. But right now, you know, I don't think the serious folks in Washington are not anticipating that Trump will remain president somehow. They are anticipating that Joe Biden on January 20th will take the oath of office.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Randy joins us next in Madison. Randy, hi.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. And happy Veterans Day. This might sound a little ridiculous, but I don't think Trump is simply acting churlishly. I think from things that I've been reading for quite some time, he feels he has twin destinies. And one of them is to win the Nobel Peace Prize. The other is to end up on Mount Rushmore. I actually believe that's something he doesn't want to let go of until reality smacks him in the face.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. There's a lot of speculation, Scott, about what's driving the president at this point and what he's angling for post-inauguration day on January 20th. I don't know. What kind of things are you hearing from people in Washington?
Well, the rumor this week from some people close to the president was that he was plotting a run again for president in 2024, a rematch against Joe Biden in 2024. I think, you know, 4 years is a long time, but if the president was at peak form 4 years from now, he would have a good shot to win the primary. I mean, 70 million people voted for President Trump despite all of the polling that had showed that it was going to be a drubbing, that Joe Biden was just going to run away with the victory. Well, things turned out a lot closer than the polling had indicated. And so some people are viewing the president's, contesting of this election as a way to sort of set himself up for 2024 with the thinking that voters want to see a fighter. They don't want to see Trump throw in the towel here. And, the more and more the president tries to paint this as a stolen election, which it's not. But if his voters and his supporters see it as a stolen election, they may be that much more motivated to support him in 2024.
We're talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer at The Hill. It's the week in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, some speculation, maybe a likelihood that Biden would reach across the aisle in forming a new administration, maybe appoint a Republican or two to his cabinet. What do you think of that idea? Good idea, bad idea. We'll also take a quick peek at Georgia along the way. A pivotal now for control of the Senate. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Scott Wong, senior writer at The Hill, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, including the transition. Scott, you wrote about possible cabinet appointments to Republicans under a Biden administration. What kind of things are we hearing?
Well, if we look back at past administrations before President Trump, Bill Clinton had, as I mentioned before, Republican William Cohen as defense secretary. George W. Bush had Democrat Norm Mineta as his transportation secretary, President Obama had three Republicans serve in his cabinet. So, you know, if we see Joe Biden as someone who is trying to return to tradition and normalcy, if you listen to his speech on Saturday, he called for ending this grim era of demonization in America. A lot of people see him moving to appoint at least one or a handful of people in his administration who would be Republicans. Reaching across the aisle, that was something that he had a reputation for. And so there's just a number of names that are being floated right now, from Cindy McCain, who endorsed Joe Biden in the presidential race against Donald Trump, to business executives like former eBay chief Meg Whitman out in California, a number of ex-governors, including John Kasich of Ohio, current governors like Larry Hogan of Maryland, where I am today, who has been praised for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. And so we'll see what happens, but there is an expectation that Biden will, in a bid to appear more bipartisan and to try to heal the country, will reach across the aisle and name one or a handful of Republicans.
But you and others have written that some progressive voices in the Democratic Party not necessarily wild about the idea, especially if they're in prominent positions.
Right. And Transportation Secretary, although transportation and infrastructure is a critical part of our country and how our economy is powered, transportation is usually the one that goes to the other party. We've seen it in past administrations. Generally, you know, you're not going to have somebody appointed from the other party going to Treasury. Commerce is a possibility, but that still seems like a stretch. Labor's probably out of the question as well. So a number of progressives, you know, the progressives, including AOC and the Justice Democrats, these outside progressive groups, have their own slate of candidates that they're putting forward. You know, people like Bernie Sanders that they're floating for labor, Keith Ellison for attorney general, people like that. And so everyone at this moment is trying to lobby the Biden transition team with their own slate of candidates who they want to see land jobs in the administration and in particular on the cabinet.
Let's bring on another caller on the transition. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi, I'm calling because my mind was significantly eased a couple of days ago when I learned that on Biden's team is Ted Kaufman, who literally with Michael Levitt wrote the Presidential Transition Inaugurations Improvement Act in 2015. So, you know, Biden has the expert on his team to address transitions. So even if Trump doesn't cooperate, we're not in as bad a situation as if, you know, Biden didn't have the significant expertise level.
Lisa, thanks for that call. And I think Ted Kaufman has a strong Delaware connection as well. Scott, as you were saying earlier, President-elect Biden trying to do this transition like it's a normal transition and trying to lock in a team here.
Right. And a lot of these folks who he has named to run the transition have decades of experience. They've served in the federal government in the past. This week, we do expect him to name his chief of staff. That will be probably his first move. Ron Klain is somebody who is one of the front runners for that chief of staff job. He is probably most notable for being the Ebola czar during the Obama administration. So he has a proven record in handling a pandemic or an outbreak of an illness, which will certainly come in handy as the Biden administration tries to tackle the coronavirus, which, as we've seen in recent days and weeks, appears to be getting worse and worse. And so he is bringing in seasoned experts, and because of his decades of experience, both on Capitol Hill as a senator and committee chairman, as well as vice president, his Rolodex is probably the biggest Rolodex in Washington today. And so, he will bring in experts and seasoned veterans as they launch their administration.
I want to look ahead now to the race for the Senate. Republicans celebrating the AP calls in Alaska and North Carolina this week for Republican incumbents there. So now it all comes down to what appear to be likely runoffs in Georgia. Hand recounts going on there because of a very close presidential election. What are we looking at in Georgia now, Scott?
Right. I mean, the political universe sort of shifts from Washington, D.C. down to Georgia. And what we're going to see in these coming weeks and months is, you know, all of the surrogates from the Biden campaign going down to Georgia and campaigning for the two Democratic candidates, John Ossoff, who's in a race against incumbent Republican David Perdue, and Raphael Warnock, the Reverend, who is running to unseat Kelly Loeffler, the Republican, there as well. And so if, you know, if the Democrats can succeed in flipping these seats, then they will have control of the Senate. And the reason why this is so significant is that, you know, if Mitch McConnell and the Republicans control the Senate, then they can slow down all of President Biden's confirmations, all of his nominations, I should say, to the executive branch, can really gum things up and slow down his agenda. So really, you know, everything, you know, all Biden's entire presidency, or at least the first couple years of his presidency, is sort of hanging in the balance with the Senate races. And that's why all eyes are back on Georgia.
Scott, thanks again for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Scott Wong, senior staff writer for The Hill. We talked to him about what's been happening since the presidential election was called for former Vice President Joe Biden as the transition period gets rolling. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the call from Governor Tony Evers yesterday for state residents to change their behavior as the number of COVID-19 cases climbs in Wisconsin. An executive order, but no new mandates. More the bully pulpit trying to get Wisconsinites to take the disease seriously. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, this can be a tough time to look for a job, especially in lines of work hit hard by the pandemic. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests share advice and information that will help make the most of a job search in tough times. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, Governor Tony Evers addressed the state last night in an effort to convince state residents to change their daily behaviors to reduce the spread of COVID-19. The governor's address came as the state reports a significant increase in the number of positive cases and deaths in Wisconsin. Today, the State Department of Health Services reported more than 7,000 new positive cases and 62 deaths reported in the last 24 hours. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What did you think about the governor's address? What would you like to see the state do to help stop the spread of COVID-19? The recommendations were just that, recommendations last night. Would you like to see more mandatory measures or not? And what are you seeing in your community when it comes to mask wearing, social distancing, and the stuff we know helps? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. In just a few minutes, we'll talk to a public health expert about the governor's address. First, Laurel White is state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Break it down first, Laurel. What did the governor have to say last night?
So this was a unique address from the governor. This was the first time that he spoke to us in prime time, a statewide address about the pandemic. And it was different from other things we've heard from him during this pandemic in one big way. And that was that he issued an executive order that was full of, as you said, recommendations. These weren't requirements. They weren't limits. The other things that his administration has tried to do up until this point have been those things, things that come with penalties if people don't follow them. Now, there's been very limited enforcement of those penalties for things like mask wearing, for example, in Wisconsin. But this was really marked in the fact that it was a departure from the way the governor has been doing things. It was a movement into just kind of urging people, asking people and businesses to change their behavior.
And his past efforts at actual mandates, talk about some of the fates they've run into.
So all of the governor or the governor's administration's orders have faced legal challenges, and those legal challenges are in different phases. There has already been an argument in one case challenging an emergency order, and we're actually looking to the state Supreme Court for arguments next week, early next week, Monday, in the statewide mask mandate case. So it certainly hasn't been smooth sailing for the governor's orders up until this point. They've been challenged in court. The other one that's kind of working its way through the system right now is the limit on public gatherings and bar and restaurant capacity in Wisconsin. A state appellate court, recently ruled on that. So we might expect that to go to the Supreme Court as well.
Speaking of things that haven't been smooth sailing, the governor's relationship with Republicans in the legislature, not so great. Have we heard much from Republicans in response to the governor's address last night?
So reporters were able to get some pretty immediate feedback from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss last night. He said that his immediate reaction was to reach out to the governor to try to set up a meeting to talk to him, because part of the governor's speech was a proclamation that the governor plans to introduce some bills related to COVID-19 responding to the pandemic in Wisconsin, or at least some proposals for bills in the coming days. And Speaker Voss said, "I really want this to be a collaborative process between Republicans and the governor's administration about how to move forward." In Speaker Voss's estimation, there hasn't been that collaborative spirit thus far between the Republican-controlled legislature and the governor's administration. He says he wants that to change. He thinks people want that to change. Now, the governor's administration, for their part, has said that they have tried to reach out to lawmakers, and that's been unsuccessful so far. And lawmakers have been slow to kind of roll out their own proposals when they've been rejecting what the governor's been trying to do. So it has absolutely, as you said, been a tricky relationship over the past several months between the governor and legislators about how to handle the pandemic.
One symptom, Laurel, I've seen reporting. Is this right? The governor and the assembly speaker haven't spoken in something on the order of 6 months?
Yes, that was a report from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, I believe, that came out yesterday. The governor and the assembly speaker are very transparent about the fact that, you know, they haven't had the smoothest relationship, certainly, arguably since the governor took office, or even before the lame duck legislative session before he took office. But there has definitely been a difference of opinion in how to handle the pandemic. The governor and his administration have favored more statewide orders. Republicans have said that the response by the state needs to be more regional to sort of take into account and respond to the fact that the virus looks different in different parts of the state. Particularly earlier on, we saw these, you know, spikes and flares in kind of more isolated places in Wisconsin. So they've just had a very philosophically different approach up until this point. But the claim now is that they're going to attempt to meet and try to iron out some plans that they can agree on.
Well, we'll see what the future holds for that. Laurel, thanks for joining us again.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is the state capitol reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She joined us for a look at Governor Tony Evers' announcement last night of new statewide COVID-19 guidelines. Now we turn to a public health expert for a look at the governor's guidelines and what we could be doing to stop the spread of COVID-19. Amanda Simonek is an associate professor of epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's one of the editors of the Dear Pandemic online forum. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me back on the program.
Let's put the governor's address in context here. We last had you on about a month ago as Wisconsin was breaking records when it came to positive tests, deaths, hospitalizations. Things are worse now, right?
Yeah, we have continued to break records in the wrong direction. Just today, there was over 7,000 new cases of COVID-19 in Wisconsin. The rolling like 7-day average is almost 6,000 cases per 100,000 persons. You know, probably in addition to the actual number of cases being detected, being alarming, is the positivity rate is just skyrocketing. You know, the positivity rate is an indicator that we're not testing enough people, that there's people out there that are going undetected as cases of COVID-19. And so knowing that this infection can be spread to others starting 2 days before you develop symptoms yourself, you know, it's a real concern that we have ongoing sort of untracked individuals that have COVID-19, you know, that are out probably transmitting it to others unknowingly at this point.
Looking at the governor's address yesterday, what stood out to you as the recommendations he offered?
I mean, this was really just a codification of what the governor, what Secretary Palm and Dr. Ryan Westergaard at the Wisconsin Department of Health Services have been asking and recommending people to do for months. I don't think there's anything drastically new. You know, we are at a point where we have to cut off sort of fuel to this virus, right? So people who are susceptible, you know, gathering together, this is how this virus spreads. And so the recommendations around basically only doing what's essential for your family at this point are really coming from a place of trying to reduce the spread of this infection in a drastic way quickly. You know, when I was on the show a month ago, I talked about how we expect a lag between surges in cases and then hospitalizations and then an increase in deaths. And right now, there's over 2,000 people that are hospitalized with COVID-19 in the state of Wisconsin. We are starting to reach hospital capacity in many locations. This is terrible for people who need to get treatment for COVID-19, but it's also going to start potentially impact those who need to seek care for other conditions as well. You know, and as our cases continue to surge, we aren't out of the woods in terms of those rates of hospitalization decreasing and then unfortunately deaths continuing to increase. And so, you know, the way to turn around this outbreak is to stop giving the virus the opportunity to spread through our communities by, you know, really limiting our social interactions to the people that we already live with to the extent possible.
I've seen reporting today about a group of health professionals and officials presenting for Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. The presentation included the Wisconsin Hospitals Association. One of the messages there is we haven't seen consistent messaging across the board from people in positions of authority and leadership, the politicization in part of COVID-19. Does doing things like having primetime addresses and getting the message out there, especially if it came from, you know, across the board, does having that message out there in and of itself make a difference?
You know, I'm sort of biased because I am somebody who keeps up with the weekly press briefings that the state health department puts out, you know, and I think in addition to like a primetime address, what we need to see is a unified front across people from different political parties in our state. You know, that the virus does not care what political party you affiliate with, you know, and when public health measures become symbols of your public health or your political affiliation, that's, you know, really undermines the ability to control this outbreak and to just undermines the pandemic response across the board, because this virus doesn't care, you know, which way you voted. If you are someone who hasn't been infected, you know, you're susceptible to it. And it's really going to require, you know, a unified approach among the Wisconsin populace to wrap your mind around the fact that you could have this infection, and before you realize you have it, you could spread it to others. Really requires us to say, okay, I'm going to wear a mask and I'm going to try to minimize my social interactions with others, even though I don't think I'm infected and I don't have symptoms yet, just because I want to try to protect my community. And that's tough to wrap your mind around, but I think that's the direction we have to move in and think, I could have this infection unknowingly, so I'm going to take the steps I need to not spread it to others.
We're talking to Amanda Simonek right now about Governor Evers' calls to Wisconsinites to change their behavior to stop the spread of COVID-19. She's Associate Professor of Epidemiology in the Joseph J. Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. She's also one of the editors of the Dear Pandemic Online Forum. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing now in your community when it comes to COVID-19? Do you work in healthcare? What is happening in your clinic or your hospital? What do you think of the governor's address? Do you want to see more mandates, or do you want to just see a unified message calling for voluntary changes? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the COVID-19 pandemic, Wisconsin's rising number of positive cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, and the calls Governor Evers made yesterday to residents to help stop the spread of the virus. Amanda Simonek stays with us, Associate Professor of Epidemiology at UW-Milwaukee. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Scott is with us in Madison. Scott, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Scott?
You know, it seems like when this all started, we all locked down and stayed home and closed all the businesses. And then when we opened back up, slowly, we all got sick. So now if we lock down again for another 6 months and we close all our businesses and then when we all come out of hiding after that, aren't we all just going to get sick again?
Gotcha. Scott, thanks for calling in. Of course, nobody's calling for a full-on lockdown at this point, or the governor isn't, certainly, Amanda. But one different thing that is on my mind, with good news, it looks like, about vaccines, maybe in the foreseeable future, I don't know, the spread we stopped today, the case we stopped today, might keep somebody alive long enough to get that vaccine now.
Yeah, we did get some good news about a vaccine being developed by the Pfizer Corporation this week. You know, I think this is the first step of good news in that process. We still need to see more data that comes out of that study. We need to, have all the safety checks marked and, you know, the process that it takes for a vaccine to come online and be readily available to the general public. We're probably looking at sometime mid-time next year before that starts to be rolled out. And then there'll be, you know, certain populations that are prioritized, like healthcare workers, older individuals, individuals that have chronic health conditions. So I do think it gives us some reason for light at the end of the tunnel. But it doesn't mean that even when that vaccine becomes available, that we will just be able to abandon all of these other mitigation strategies. I think we're going to need a layered approach for a while that will be where a vaccine gets added into the mix. But we have reason for optimism now that will hopefully be coming available. But yes, you're right. We don't want to just say, okay, there's a vaccine on the horizon, so let's just sort of let go of all these other precautions that we have available to us to slow the spread of COVID-19. You know, I think we want to prevent as many illnesses and deaths as possible from this infection. I've been on the program before and, you know, talked about how it's not just preserving our hospital capacity and preventing deaths. While those two things are very important, it's also, you know, that people who get this infection sometimes have long-term complications from this infection, even without ending up hospitalized or dying. So we have all, you know, the same motivations and reasons to continue to try to slow the spread of this infection with a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel with the good vaccine news this week.
Thanks for that call, Scott. We'll go to Ron now in Milwaukee. Ron, hi.
Yes, thank you for being here and opening up these ideas. My comment is regarding things I've always heard about from my parents and grandparents about them having victory gardens and scrap metal drives, voluntarily trying to do something for the community when the world was in crisis. They had rationing for sugar, meat, nylon stockings, gasoline, etc. And they accepted this as part of the way to aid the community and feel patriotic. And now we have people feeling put upon because they might be spreading something, but that's taking away their freedom. And they feel they can be cavalier and angry even in your face when asked to please wear a mask.
Ron, thanks a lot for that call. Ron, calling for, a community spirit in trying to fight this, Amanda.
Yeah, I hope for that too, right? I think, again, that I repeat the messaging around the fact that, you know, this is an infection that's different than other respiratory infections. With something like flu, you're typically most symptomatic the day or are able to transmit to others the day you develop symptoms. And usually if you have fever, you know, you're tired, you are worn out, you maybe stay home those days. And so the transmission of flu gets disrupted in that way. But with this infection, unfortunately, before you realize that you have it, you can spread it to others. And so it does take and will take an embracing by our communities to say, look, I'm going to wear a mask when I go out in public. I'm going to cut down my social circles. You know, I'm going to sort of limit my social interactions to the extent I can right now to protect others. You know, I don't want to be the person who accidentally gets exposed, you know, through an interaction that I thought was safe or didn't feel was risky and then pass that infection along to other people, you know. And the reality is that with the rates of transmission that are happening in our communities in Wisconsin right now, the likelihood that you will encounter someone, you know, even at the grocery store or in a, you know, a neighbor who has to go in and work, you know, and can't work from home. These types of sort of everyday interactions are going to unfortunately become more likely to be sources of transmission.
Ron, thanks for that call. We'll go to Amanda now in Slinger. Amanda, hello. Amanda, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you so much for my call. I really appreciate the show and the advice and the everything you guys are doing. My family has been able to steer clear of the virus. However, my elderly parents and my brother and sister-in-law recently tested positive and were able to recover. They were fortunate to have a mild case. My question is it safe to celebrate Thanksgiving with them?
Well, I think I'll tackle Thanksgiving in general right now and then that specific scenario. So, you know,
and just a minute and a half left, Amanda. I'm sorry.
Sure. Just in terms of Thanksgiving in general right now, you know, the safest way that we can celebrate is with our own household, the people who we already interact with. You know, today is marking 2 weeks until the Thanksgiving holiday. And, you know, unless you really, your household and any other household you plan to gather with can meaningfully do a strict 2-week quarantine where you don't, you know, interact with anyone, you don't go to the grocery store, you don't go to work, you don't go to in-person school, and you kind of remove any possibility of exposure. And then 2 weeks pass by because you, you know, have passed that incubation period during which you would expect symptoms to develop. It's just really going to be difficult to guarantee that you haven't been infected and won't bring that with to your gathering. And I don't think anyone wants to pass COVID-19 along with the mashed potatoes or turkey to their family members. In terms of having family members that have already been infected, you know, we're still learning about what the long-term immunity is to COVID-19 and whether, you know, it would be safe to sort of be in this window of time where if your family members were re-exposed, they wouldn't get another infected again. And so I think, you know, the safer option is to not gather, you know, in this 2-week quarantine.
And we have to leave it there. Thanks to Amanda Simonek from UW-Milwaukee, epidemiologist there with us to look at the governor's announcement yesterday on COVID-19 steps in Wisconsin. A lot of people have been trying new things and setting new goals during the pandemic. Some are exercising and maybe trying to get those washboard abs, not me. But it turns out that a lot of people are buying actual washboards. As reported in the Smithsonian Magazine, there's exactly one factory in the United States that makes washboards. The Columbus Washboard Company, founded not in the real Columbus here in Wisconsin, but that other Columbus in Ohio. It's now in Logan, Ohio. If you haven't encountered these washboards or those, you know, wood and metal ridged racks you can use to scrub your laundry. They're also used as percussion instruments in Zydeco and other genres. Well, the Columbus Washboard Company says they usually sell about 80,000 a year, more than I would have expected. 40% they figure for people wanting to do their washing, 40% for music, the rest for decoration. This year, they have seen sales double. From their shipping addresses, the company says a lot of the sales are going to apartment buildings. So they think people who usually rely on laundromats have switched to washing at home with their new washboards. The first washboard patent goes back to 1797, though they were probably around long before that. Washboards came to dominate the clothes washing world until the development of washing machines in the early 1900s. Came to use as a cheap and distinctive musical instrument along the way. Here's a listen to the washboard in action in music, not cleaning. This is Central Time.